We have with us here Mikey Siegel, who is a robotics engineer turned consciousness hacker. He envisions a present and future where science and technology support psychological, emotional, and spiritual flourishing, where our devices not only connect us to information, but also connect us to ourselves and each other, acting as a catalyst for individual and collective awakening. He is currently a lecturer at Stanford University, founder of Consciousness Hacking, Biofluent Technologies, and the Transformative Technology Conference. He received an MS in robotics from the MIT Media Lab. And he's also the first to take a printed version of the iConscious Human Development Model and frame it and put it on the wall.
My biggest claim to fame right there. My biggest achievement so far
in our universe.
First of all, Mikey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today and offer some information to our John F. Kennedy University students. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure to be here.
So I think a good place to start, Mikey, is to, if you would let us know how you got into consciousness hacking and what you mean by that term.
Sure. So my path in was from the engineering side. And I guess actually not really from the engineering side, but I'll explain that in a second. So started off as an engineer, really a lifelong interest in tinkering and building and taking things apart. Ended up studying computer engineering and doing my graduate work in robotics. And all along during that time, even from a young age, there was an interest in the esoteric, in the mystical, in what was beyond. And it was like an intellectual curiosity. Because a lot of people that get into consciousness maybe have some sort of early crazy mystical experience and are trying their whole life to explain it. That wasn't my case. I was actually always trying to have crazy experiences and was sort of locked in the mental space. But I was always fascinated by those ideas, reading books and this kind of thing. But it wasn't until after I finished graduate school that I was propelled by my own suffering. Mm-hmm. By my own existential angst, by my own sense of being disconnected and out of touch with why I was even here. What was the meaning of this? What is the purpose of this existence? And I ended up on a yoga ashram in Virginia for 2 months. And that was my first experiential dive into meditation. And what I discovered, most importantly, was that I had basically been missing half the equation. I had completely ignored essentially my whole inner world as part of my whole life exploration. And as an engineer, I had been spending my life sort of building and tinkering and fixing things and studying things all outside and never looking inside. And so what I realized was the profound importance of that, what you could call that inner work, but really the work of developing our understanding and our relationship to ourselves and reality in a deep and fundamental way. And I realized that that was important not just for me, but it was actually important in terms of the whole shape and quality and evolution of humanity. And that really the shape and texture of what we create as humanity is very much a function of our inner world, collective inner world, the collective state of human consciousness. And so when I started to realize that, I saw that I had these two separate things in my life, engineering and tech on one side, and then this interest in and profound importance placed on this inner evolution on the other side. And then snap. It wasn't really actually a snap. It's more of a gradual realization that not only were these not separate, because they feel separate, you know, you're holding your cell phone in one hand and your meditation cushion in the other. They don't feel like the same endeavor, right? They feel very different. What I realized was, even though they felt different, actually, they weren't fundamentally different. We had culturally created the difference, But actually, when I thought about what I wanted to build as an engineer, the most exciting, fascinating, interesting, rewarding thing that I could imagine building as an engineer were tools that could support the evolution of human consciousness, the support self-awareness, support the decrease in human and resolution of human suffering, to support compassion, to support connection, to support joy, to support acceptance, you know, that whole space of human experience.
And so this sounds like your definition of consciousness hacking.
So this, for me, is consciousness hacking is this, I would call it spiritual innovation, right? How can we take a new, fresh, out-of-the-box, innovative approach to developing tools, pointers, paths, mechanisms, systems that can continue in this modern age to support the human experience in a deep way?
It also sounds to me like you went from focusing solely, to use Ken Wilber's four quadrants, you went from focusing solely on the upper right quadrant, which is the objective, to integrating and realizing that there is an essential piece that was missing for you, which was the upper left quadrant, and what we call the subjective, and the intermix of those and how they're not completely separate, but actually how they all arise, actually all at the same time.
And you also mentioned about culture, how culture affects us and how we affect culture. That's in the lower right quadrant.
And then the lower left quadrant. And the lower left being the relational element. So it's interesting to hear the starkness between how you had those separated and how they're actually simultaneously, all four quadrants are arising in your experience and how you live in the world.
Yeah, I see these things all being bridged in a beautiful way. And I would even just add, in terms of the quadrant conversation, what has spawned is that one of my biggest focal points in terms of what technology can do is on the interpersonal side, right? How technology can be used to actually support a collective social interpersonal experience, as opposed to not just the sort of solitary meditative individual internal experience.
So I have a question about what you're working on, and I don't know the details, and feel free not to share anything that's confidential, but anything you can tell us about what you're doing in this field, we'd love to hear.
My life is open source. Anyone who wants to build a new version of me, it's all there's lots to improve on. Yeah. So there are three main focal points for me. There's my projects, the technology that I'm actually working on and helping to develop. Then there's teaching, so teaching part-time at Stanford. And then there's consciousness hacking, which is a global organization bringing together the makers, the entrepreneurs, and the researchers, and the scientists, all focused on building these new tools. And that constitutes about 50% of my time. The other 50% is doing this sort of thing, which is a lot of talks, outreach, interviews, connecting people, meetings, email. So there's a huge amount of just organically finding myself as a kind of a supporter of the general emergence of this space. So that's what the slice of Mikey's pie looks like. Now, to help, it's the most tangible thing is probably the stuff I'm building. So we can talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
I've been increasingly interested in how technology can be used to connect people. Probably stemming from, I think if we really are honest and we introspect, a lot of the things that we're passionate about are usually things that we're like in some way looking for or connected to or wanting in our life more, you know? And so for me, when I look, I've been building technology around human connection. And also one of the things that I've been working on, my own edge, has been around deepening my capacity for felt human connection.
Well, now this is interesting because I think a lot of people would equate increasing high technology with decreasing human contact.
Yes.
What would you say?
Yeah. So I would say that is the way we've designed it.
Right.
Yes. And it's true. And it's true. And I would say that we create technology as a reflection, not just technology, everything, art, poetry, like architecture,
culture,
political systems, culture, right. We create, everything we create is a reflection of who and what we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reflection of the creator,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't separate the paintbrush mm-hmm. from the artist's hand, from the canvas. It's one seamless thing that connects to the artist's beliefs and biases and dreams and fears. It's all woven in there. And the same thing is true for a high-tech Silicon Valley CEO.
So you would say that there's nothing inherent in the technology that's anti-human connection.
Technology is our human capacity to manifest our ideas and thoughts. And even more specifically, I would say technology is just the application or expression of science in a way. And science can be used to understand and explore anything in reality, from consciousness to microorganisms to the furthest reaches of the universe. So anything we put our shine our light of science onto and build a kind of quantitative understanding, that understanding can then in turn be used to develop new tools and technologies.
So I hear you saying that where the tools are built from, where it's coming from, yeah. is dramatically a huge dramatic piece. And yes. I couldn't agree more with you than that, that internal and the manifestation of the external, they're completely congruent. So would you say that it's actually the hard technology itself then that's produced, or also kind of what it's used for in where it's coming from, if that makes sense?
I think I understand your question. Well, I agree with everything you're saying, but I don't know if I understood the question part. But so I'll just try and answer. So yes, this is huge for me. So
yeah.
when I started with the consciousness hacking thing, my mission was to build the enlightenment button, you know, like I'm going to engineer enlightenment, you know, and
like Woody Allen's orgasmatron.
Yes. Yes. And so it was very much about building the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And, what I've realized over time was that I am inseparable from the thing
mm-hmm.
and that I can't, and that my own process of transformation, my own clarity, my own capacity for wisdom and insight, my own fears, my own biases will all color what I'm creating. And so it's impossible for me to separate my own inner work and my own journey from what I'm building in the world. And that doesn't mean that I have to stop because I'm not enlightened yet, so I can't do anything useful.
Did you go through a phase like that?
I've been through phases like that.
I have too. I'm just curious. Yeah. I feel the same with you.
Totally. Where you think like, you know, oh, I'm just going to like bring more pain into the world.
Exactly.
And, you know,
exactly.
And so what I've come up with is something like the path of the transformative technologist, where the path of the creation process is a spiritual path itself, right? Where we see our own reflection in what we're creating and we're constantly learning from it. And it's just a seamless part of everything else that we're learning from and growing from. And in 5 years, we'll look back at what we created. And of course, we'll see how we've built our pain into it and where we were at the time. But that's beautiful. And that's all part of the process. And so I'll give you a concrete example. Okay. It's all very abstract. Technology I built a few years ago, which is actually, it's on a permanent installation at the Tech Museum in San Jose, so you can go play with it, is something called HeartSync. And the idea is, how do you use technology to connect a group of people together? And the way that it works is up to 6 people connect to a sensor that measures your heart rate variability. This is the change in your heart rate over time. And then those 6 people are guided in a basically, it's not called this, but it's basically a breath meditation, right? And for a lot of the people showing up at the museum, like these are like a lot of 9-year-olds getting off a school bus, they've never even heard of meditation before, right? But this guides them through a sort of a breathing process that's designed to bring the group into a state of heart-based synchrony.
Mm. Wow.
And so essentially winning is equivalent to not only calming and balancing your own physiology, but becoming physiologically in harmony with the people around you. Mm. So the cool part about this is it kind of gamifies meditation in a way, and kids get into it and they're like, ah, you know, but as I watched people interact with it, what I realized is that it became very competitive and very goal oriented. And that when you looked at the screen showing the visualization of everyone's heart pattern, which is how you know what you're sort of quote unquote, where you're at, that you can see the other people around you and you can be like, oh, well, Billy is like totally more connected than I am right now, you know, and I'm totally losing right now. And so all of this, this competition, this sense of comparison, this notion of there being a goal and you not being at the goal yet, it actually has the opposite effect of what you would want in a tool that's supposed to support a contemplative experience.
So on our model, we have different stages or what we call chapters of development. And in spiral dynamics and Ken Wilber's system, it's orange. And what we call it is the striving achieving. And so do you feel that, have you seen patterns of perhaps students that are responding differently to these technology tools based on their stage or chapter of development, whether they're in the rational striving or whether they're actually the one beyond it, the equality, harmony, or whether they're in more like what they call the teal. Obviously a lot of kids aren't in teal, but would you say that you've noticed patterns of the underlying value system that these kids are coming from and how they're responding to your tools?
Yeah, I haven't done an explicit study of that, but my guess would be yes. It would be yes. And my guess actually would be that ideally what would happen is, as designers, we would take this into consideration and we would be actually designing different tools for people that are in different stages of development.
Cool to hear.
And so, but, and the interesting thing was this, the reason why this was designed this way is because it was probably a reflection of a stage of development that I was in.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the time. And I was able to learn that. From studying and understanding the effect that the technology was having. And then I went back to the drawing board and I designed a new technology, right? Which was probably a reflection of a different sort of stage of development a few years later, which had a different sort of premise, right? Where this was a dome structure for two people to sit inside of. It's downstairs. We can look at it there.
Oh, neat.
The goal here is a little different. There's no destination, right? There's no goal. There's no points. There's no score. There's no comparison. There's nothing like that. I got away from all of that. And really the goal here is to create an environment that supports a present moment embodied, mutual embodied experience, a feeling of yourself and the other person. And the way I do this is by connecting each person to two sensors, one that measures their heart and one that measures their breath. And then each person can see and feel the other person's heart and breath in the space. And so, for example, if we're sitting across from each other, I could actually see your breath as a halo of light that emerges behind you on the inhale. And when you exhale, it goes to darkness. And when you inhale, there's the sound of an ocean wave cresting. And when you exhale, the wave crashes. And we can feel each other's heartbeat through a personal subwoofer behind our backs. So it's literally the vibration of each other's heart. And
that's
so it's all nonverbal. It's all non-conceptual. And it's, when you think about it, what is your sensory experience filled with? It's filled with the reflection of the embodied experience of another person. And so it brings you in touch with that person in a kind of a sensual, sense-based kind of way.
In a way, you're actually going beyond what normal human senses could have done to a whole other level of connectedness that we weren't even wired for until now.
So what I would say is you are amplifying, exactly right, our normal sensory capacity, but really it's to open the door wider. for what I believe is our innate capacity for connection. So I don't think I'm changing our capacity for connection. I think what I'm changing is our ability to tap into it. Mm-hmm. Because we have so many walls that are up. We have so much conditioning. We have so many barriers that we place. Mm-hmm. And so if technology can help soften those boundaries and help make it more accessible to that capacity we already have, which is so deep, that's really powerful.
It almost sounds like you're wanting to build technologies that are sort of like neurochemicals to help the neurons talk to each other, something like that, like creating lubrication in the environment for the kind of embodied experience you want to promote.
Yes. And for the project now that I'm working on, it's even more explicit, where I'm literally both doing this research side and the development side of how can you literally bring the brain and heart into direct synchrony. Yeah. Recognizing that, or a hypothesis is that human connection is actual harmonizing. Like imagine people playing instruments together, right? When a symphony is actually like creating beautiful music, it's because all the instruments are in a beautiful rhythm and harmony. And I believe you can literally measure the same thing happening in human beings when they get into a state of group flow and connection, that their brains and their bodies and their hearts literally get into a symphony with each other.
So it sounds to me almost like, you know, we talked a little about Integral. It sounds to me a little bit like Integral and like our model that we've developed and emphasizing the importance of the consciousness domain, as well as the head, as well as the heart, as well as the body, as well as your unique design. And how can all of these arise and come online at one time while not exclusively identifying with one and getting lost in just the head or just the heart or just the body. And not only doing that with all five domains simultaneously individually, but as well as collectively, whether it's with one other person or multiple other people or a culture, a community of people.
Yeah, totally agree. And we had Ken speak at one of our events a while back. And for me, that was really important. And not just because Ken is an important figure and all that stuff, but because he's bringing forth a view that you're both holding strongly as well, that is not held very consciously or strongly in this space of developing these new tools, which is the recognition that we have to take into consideration these multiple facets of human development and experience, right? You know, you were putting certain terms to it, but, you know, Ken often talk about the waking up, the growing up, the cleaning up, these different qualities. And usually the tech in this space is just focused on the waking up part. Right. And maybe some people are starting to think about sort of the cleaning up part, but nobody is thinking about or aware of the growing up part. And you made a great point earlier, and that is that people are probably unconsciously, just like they were doing in spiritual traditions and religious traditions throughout the centuries, same thing is happening with technology. Unconsciously designing technology from a certain stage of development.
Yep.
And then it's going to be unconsciously targeted for people and optimizing unconsciously for that stage of development.
Right. And we're noticing that there are, we have three main dimensions. We have the four views that we've talked about in the beginning of this interview and how some people target are at home in one view, but not all views or not, or, you know, and we also have the stages or chapters of development. Where are they in their actual stage of development and the importance of that and how you bring technology into the world. And then on the domains, you know, a lot of people are just focusing on consciousness or the wake up part, and others are ignoring, heart, mind, body, design, the psychological element of it. And what would it be like if we actually brought all three dimensions together of spiritual, psychological, as well as stage of development, as well as what viewpoint we're holding? And can we be vast enough to hold all three dimensions at one time while we're creating technology tools and offering them into the world from that space, that vast space? And what would technology look like if we actually held all of those pieces while developing?
Hallelujah.
Yeah. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. So this is beautiful. And this really emphasizes what for me is become one of the most important parts of my whole journey and what I'm thinking needs to happen in terms of how these things are developed is that we need to make a new culture or evolve the culture of making.
Absolutely.
Evolve the culture of the of entrepreneurship, of startups. And in order for us, startups are the therapists and the spiritual teachers and the healers of the future, whether we like it or not. Just by sheer numbers and market demand.
Interesting. Right.
There is a market demand for healing, for spiritual awakening, for all of these things. And so there are going to be clever people that are starting companies to get these things, interventions distributed out to tens or hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
And so the reach is going to be orders of magnitude beyond what any individual clinician in an office could ever do. And so if startups are the healers, the therapists, the spiritual teachers of the future, if they're not grounded experientially in that, then what are they going to be teaching?
So if they are the future in terms of getting all this out and creating, how might we, what tools, what technology tools would be most useful to bring to the table to those people that are going to be the biggest, you know, shakers coming up?
You mean for the makers, for the,
yeah.
So what I'm seeing emerging actually is a growing interest and activity around like corporate consulting, advising, innovation, in terms of bringing consciousness into corporate structures. So sort of the raising of corporate consciousness. The other thing that I'm seeing showing up is evolving of organizational structures. Mm. And so my general view of kind of like what's happening mm-hmm. is that sort of awakening is one way to put it, can happen everywhere, mm-hmm. right? And I see awakening happening and incredible awakening potential in all human structures, mm-hmm. political structures, financial structures, educational structures. So if you look at any of those domains, you can start to see examples of how those things are beginning to shift mm-hmm. The structure, mm-hmm. sort of the stage mm-hmm. of development that they're mm-hmm. kind of referencing, shifting the language around which they're, you know, referring to things, you know, all of these qualities are beginning to change. And so you're starting to see qualities like decentralization, shifts in hierarchies. Mm-hmm. You're starting to see different models for sharing, for transparency, for honesty, for openness, different mm-hmm. ways in which concerns for the well-being and welfare of human beings are being incorporated into the bottom line of mm-hmm. companies. You know, all of these things mm-hmm. are beginning to emerge, right? And so that's what I see happening, and that's mm-hmm. what needs to continue to happen.
So that is, it's awesome. I see a lot of the same stuff, yeah. and it's a lot of it is people to people, you know, people development type stuff, and coaches going in, consultants going in, reorganizations going in. It takes a lot of manpower, if you will. Mm-hmm. Where does technology come into this to help expedite this process? So we're not just relying on those that have the capacity to go in and shake shit up for like, I'll have to take that out, shake things up. You know, where does technology come in? I mean, one of the things that is our goal with iConscious is accelerating human development. Yeah. So there's two of us, one of you. How do we utilize technology to expedite this process?
Yeah. So, that's everything that we're, you know, that's like, that's it,
big
right?
Question,
that's like, that's where I've spent the last 5 years trying to figure out. And so there's a lot of ways of trying to answer that question, meaning we could talk about like different types of technologies, you know, like what could be useful technology. We could talk about technology design principles. We could talk about how to integrate the tech. We could talk about all these different things. That's kind of hard because there's so many details. That could be like a whole class, you know, that's what mm-hmm. I'm teaching. So what I'll back up and what I'll say is that technology is particularly useful for this purpose because technology can act as a bridge, right? If you look around and you say, what is universal across cultures, across geography, across belief system, what human constructs? And it's not language, right? Language changes from place to place. It's not food, right? Lots of people don't like each other's food. It's not music. It's not clothing, right? It's certainly not religion. What's universal? For example, almost anyone would be happy to have an iPhone.
True.
Almost anyone would be
except
happy.
For the diehard Android users. Or not be happy with an iPhone.
A cell phone, yeah. A mobile device. Yeah, anything you get, there's going to be conflict. Right. It's true.
Who would want the ultimate oracle in their pocket?
So if technology, like over 90% of the world, not 90% of the human population, because there's two cell phones for every human being. Two active cell phones for every human being on the planet.
Including the babies?
Including the babies.
Oh my God.
No. That doesn't mean that every
that
person has two
have
cell phones.
It, right.
Now, when you look at who has access to phones, over 90% of the world's population has an active, at least one active cell phone account.
Really?
Over 90%.
Wow.
I remember when
That's
I was
amazing.
In India and I was with these sadhus who literally are naked. They're covered with ash.
They have
and
a
I'm
cell phone.
Sitting around the fire and I hear like a phone ring and I'm all embarrassed. I'm like, oh God, my phone is ringing. And the guy like picks up the phone. I'm like, where did he even keep it? He's got like a loincloth on him. I don't even know where the phone came from. And
maybe it was the loincloth that was ringing.
It's true. So there, you know, technology is ubiquitous and it's universally accessible. It doesn't matter what religion you are, what belief system you are. And so the question is, what if you could make deep, skillful pointers to transformation as accessible as cell phones? And I think this goes to your question about sort of what can transform kind of this culture of the makers. A lot of these folks are deeply embedded in a science tech driven belief system and structure and worldview. And so if you can design the interventions to come through tech, backed by science, then all of a sudden you've built a bridge that a spiritual teacher or consciousness model may never be able to bridge.
Yeah, which is interesting because statistically, according to Ken Wilber, I'm sure this has shifted in the last year or two, chapter 4, Rational Striving, makes up over 50% of North American population. Mm-hmm. And so it makes complete sense that that would be the doorway that we target to get into and start to make those transformations.
And it is the doorway that we are targeting. And, you know, your description of the best way to get at people with technology to help them grow really describes what our game plan is. Mm-hmm. Our game, you know, we didn't just do this model for the model. We did this model to build digital resources on top of it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as soon as we're done with the, you know, the book and a few more things on the website, that's where we're going.
Yeah, we plan to, like, how do we get this model out there to scale it to awaken millions of people as much as possible?
Right. And it isn't just by showing the model.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to hear also different things that you see, specific tools. You know, I know you mentioned there are different modalities of technology we could discuss, but what do you see as specific tools that could be real game changers in getting into corporations or getting into the bottom or through, you know, the chapter four Rational Strivers that could be utilized to help facilitate that shift?
And also, I want to hear what you're working on now. Maybe those two are connected.
Mm-hmm. They are connected. You guys are good. Feel good here. So it needs to come through what the needs are of that population, right? So first and foremost, like a design principle for technology, transformative technology, you need to meet people where they're at, right? And so if you can connect to what would be beneficial for them, what would serve the needs of that population, then you have something that can connect in. And so one approach that I'm taking is creating a technology that can make meetings more efficient and more productive. And doing that by at one level, using sort of the trendy term of creating an experience of group flow. Mm-hmm. But deeper than that, right, group flow can be created when we begin to lower our boundaries, mm-hmm. when we can feel safer, mm-hmm. more yes. vulnerable, right? When the sense of separateness, the boundaries between self and other, when those begin to soften mm. and become a little bit more malleable, right? And so if you can accomplish that and make a meeting 15% more efficient and have people feel more creative and get along better, then that is a win-win situation.
Awesome.
Right? And so the question is, what are the win-win situations, mm-hmm. right? And I think there are other tools and technologies that are beginning to work their way. For example, you'll find technology tools for meditation, right? Like the Muse headset. And I think you'll see more and more adoption of those kinds of technologies because the research is showing more and more and more that mindfulness and other interventions are actually beneficial for the workplace.
I have a quick question before you move on, because yeah. I am curious about this piece about taking, for instance, meetings, making them more efficient yeah. within corporations. You know, there are some cultures that are known to be more orange or rational striving, more cultures that are known to be more green, and more cultures that are known to be more teal, or what yeah. we're calling inclusive. So when you create technology, are you creating technology to take that into accommodation? Because you will have a different flavor in how they'll respond to those pieces and how meetings are run.
Yeah. Great question. And, it's really, really, it's a good question. And it's funny because this is a new thinking space for me because I'm recognizing the importance of it, but I haven't begun to really think about it in the design space. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really glad that you're bringing it up and giving me a chance to think about it. And I think that it's, happens unconsciously. Right. So, when I'm, and you know, my collaborators are thinking about the tech, I think that we're projecting a certain use case scenario mm-hmm. that is probably automatically assuming a kind of rational striving
sure.
type, you know, perspective. And so,
perhaps only because that's what dominates the business culture.
Totally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
Absolutely.
We're thinking, what's the market? And then mm-hmm. we feel into it and mm-hmm. we're not using those words. But I think it's an implicit thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be nice to make it more explicit.
Yeah, and then just to think, you know, if it is orange, how do I meet them where they are, and what's the next step for this group, mm-hmm. and then what's the next technology tool that can meet the mm-hmm. equality harmony group?
Yeah,
and what does that technology piece look like to help facilitate them to inclusive teal?
Yes.
Yeah, and totally. Then how do you assess that when the technology is in the room listening to people at all different levels of development
mm-hmm.
with all different kind of conditioned ways of viewing the world?
Well, I think there's a way to assess a corporation, what the corporate culture naturally
yeah.
kind of gravitates
yeah.
toward the culture's center yeah. of gravity, just like we can individually,
yeah.
which could
yeah.
potentially be done outside of technology and then bring the
yeah.
technology tool in.
Yeah,
that's very interesting.
Although I think one of the biggest innovations that we could see, or a really exciting one that I could see you guys already working on, is how can we create automated, really easy tech-based ways of
yes,
assessing
absolutely,
where people are at.
Absolutely.
It's
That's
one of our
the
goals.
Very yeah. next pieces that we're working on.
Yeah.
So can I shift a little bit?
Please.
And ask some more more out there questions. So I'm kind of, part of what I'm feeling here in this conversation mm-hmm. is the thing that I had mentioned to you earlier, which is that it's almost as if I feel as if we're building a neural infrastructure on the outside to represent how we're growing on the inside.
Mm.
That's kind of how I think about technology, that it's almost as if it's an external nervous system that connects the whole planet and will allow us to have a completely different type of consciousness.
Mm.
How do you relate to that?
Yeah, I relate to it. So I have a similar
mm-hmm.
view. I think that one of our defining human qualities is not just the fact that we use technology. It's actually our dependency
mm-hmm.
on technology. And this is I say that word dependency, I could use other words, mm-hmm. but I say it
mm-hmm.
knowing that it's a kind of a pokey
mm-hmm.
word
mm-hmm.
because that's one of the things people are most afraid of when I talk about these things is, oh, now we're just going to be dependent on this thing for my spiritual development. You know, and I've got this, like, I can't even meditate without a technology. What a horror, you know, like, you know, this
idea. You're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, the wrong direction, right? We're just developing more technological dependency. And the thing that I like to point out is that we are so far past the point of we were technologically dependent when fire was invented and we started cooking food.
Yes.
Right? You know, thousands and thousands of years ago. We're so far past that that even though to think about it becomes sort of preposterous, but let's just pretend if technology were to disappear, 99.9% of humanity would be dead within days.
Okay. Right? Really that much?
Well, what percent of the human population could you drop into a completely natural environment? Completely natural.
You mean all of a sudden the world is a jungle?
No textiles.
Oh, okay.
No
shoes. Got it. That kind of thing.
Nothing. Yeah, I mean, no human invention.
Right. No human invention.
A human being literally dropped into a natural environment. What percent of humanity could survive? Mm. And my guess is it's far less than 0.01%.
Right. It ain't much.
You know, from everything from electricity to water to like our basic, like, you know, capacity to create clothing and all these kinds of things. So we're deeply dependent on technology. And so the question is not, do we want to avoid technological dependency?
Yeah.
Right? That's out of the question. Mm-hmm. The question seems to be some sort of judgment call we're making about where we want to have the dependency and where we don't want to have the dependency. For example, like, I'm using Google Maps to get everywhere. Yes. And I'm like, I'm kind of surrendering to it. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm just not putting any effort anymore into navigating. And like, and here's what I realize is happening. The more I do that, the more I'm really losing a certain amount of agency, a certain amount of independence, independent functioning to this system, to the collective, to the technological landscape, right? And in order to do that, what I'm gaining is that I'm freeing up that cognitive burden. And I'm also gaining like a much better navigational capacity than what I have inherent, right? I'm gaining this collective intelligence, right? But the risk is that if all of a sudden the internet is gone or I lose my phone,
China knocks out one of our satellites.
Right. Or just like, I even like, look, well, let's say I'm like somewhere and somewhere there's like no phone anywhere. I need to get home. Like, it could be really hard.
She just went through this. Right?
I literally just went through that. And I was completely dependent on Google Maps. And I told the guy at the Apple store, like, I will not be able to get home unless we get this phone.
Yes.
I'm going to turn this on.
And I had that moment that you're describing of feeling that shift in agency, feeling how much I was dependent on that phone, primarily for Google Maps, for other pieces as well. But for that particular, you know, piece, it was huge. And the thought came the exact same thing. What am I gaining by utilizing this and overutilizing and letting go of really recognizing where my surroundings are and where I'm at, but what am I gaining?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing. There's no answer here, but it's a thing to think about. It's like, what does it mean to fully surrender to a collective intelligence, to this emerging, evolving, growing collective structure, what Kevin Kelly might call the technium, right? And what does it mean as we one by one by one let go of our ability to do it ourselves? And we say, okay, I'm going to let go of that and I'm going to gain something that's more than what I could ever do myself.
It seems to me that one of the big keys in all that is learning, is helping people learn how to make discriminations and decisions about what kinds of technologies versus what kinds of more direct contacts with people that they're choosing. I think it's very much like the thing with the map as an analogy, because like you could say directions to San Carlos and Siri will take you to San Carlos and you might find out a day later, oh, I meant San Carlos, California, not Mexico. Right. So people need to learn in the same way when we went from arithmetic to calculators and people are like, oh, I guess the answer is 10 billion. And they're not discriminating how to use the technology. They don't know where to put the decimal point. I think there's an issue there with how we use technology. Do you feel that?
Part of it is a mismatch. So when I was, for my research, for my graduate research, I brought this humanoid robot into the tech museum in San Jose. And one of the things I asked people is sort of their, how they perceive the robot. And what I found is that younger people often felt that the robot was as smart or smarter than humans. And there's a mismatch there, right? Where they are perceiving the technology to have a certain intelligence and capacity than it actually has, partly because it's designed
to make them think that.
And so we have design flaws within the system that create that kind of incoherence and discrepancy. And so
this sort of reminds me of how people have personalities to project a certain part of themselves.
Exactly what I was thinking. The same design flaws exist in human interaction. Same thing. And we do the same thing. We will trust in someone. And so we'll kind of drop our guard a little and allow them to sort of make decisions for us, you know, and we won't use critical thinking. It's like so what I found in my research, the robot, is that whether people are conscious of it or not, when people are interacting with technology, they essentially conform to basic principles of social interaction, whether they know it or not. And actually, there was a book written about it called The Media Equation by a guy named Cliff Nass. I highly recommend it. And it basically was study after study after study that showed that basically we're wired for social interaction. It doesn't matter what we're interacting with.
Wow.
It's just how we're wired. We don't discriminate. We can't, on a level, we can't discriminate, even though consciously we think we are. And so that means that as this sort of technological environment emerges around us, we will be interfacing with it as if it's a living thing.
Wow. How long before the living thing becomes more enlightened than the individuals?
That's a loaded question.
That's what we're here for.
Because it presumes a lot.
Yes.
That there is a thing separate from the individuals and that you can draw a clear boundary between them. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, in investigating what's emerging here, there's a lot of interesting questions. Are you separate from your reflection in the mirror? And I don't know. It's debatable, right? It's like, well,
depends on your perspective.
It's over there. It's on a separate piece of glass. And it's, you know, it's like, it's not me. It's just light bouncing off a thing, you know? So you could imagine it's a separate thing. And then you could say, does the reflection and you have independent existence?
Apparently not.
They don't, because you can't have one without the other.
Right.
And am I isolated to being right here?
Right.
It's the sort of thing Julia is investigating.
Yeah.
Right. And we had a great dinner guest last night, Dustin DiPerna.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we got into some interesting conversations. And one thing that sparked, I have these little idea seeds that maybe we will one day be like little book chapters or something. I don't know. But one of them is like this emerging kind of a half-baked idea that when you look at the deep, far reaches of spiritual traditions, Buddhist traditions and yogic traditions, which I've done very little of, peaked, you find some pretty far out stuff, right? What is being pointed to as the space of human experience that can be attained from cities, right? Sort of human powers to the far reaches of Buddhahood and enlightenment, what happens to the physical body at those, at that time, and the different things that are possible. I won't alienate anyone by going into those details. But when I look, for example, now I give an example because it's important. So one of the things that's talked about in these far out reaches is something called rainbow body, right? Where there's a capacity, and I'm not claiming that this is true.
It's more Dan Brown's work, right?
Yes. So Dan Brown can point to this sometimes. So that at the very, very far reaches, when you've sort of cosmically cleaned out every ounce of karma from past lives and future lives and multiple dimensions, and really it's just like it's like full Buddhahood in a way, that there's a potential for you to actually in a sense dematerialize, to actually fundamentally shift your substrate into light. And regardless of that, whether or not it's being true, just to say it's part of a certain, not all Buddhism, but a certain type of Tibetan Buddhist cosmology, right? Now, when you look at what's being pointed to in certain aspects of like transhumanist, technological and science-driven evolution, well, a lot of the goals there are about our ability to put consciousness, create a digital manifestation of consciousness, to actually see ourselves transmuted into a digital, i.e. electronic, i.e. non-physical, non-tangible form, right? Digital information.
The servers are still tangible.
Huh?
The servers are still
tangible. Right. But those are just manifestations or carriers for that digital information with itself at its heart is non-physical. Information doesn't have a form. It has a representation as transistors, but those are just temporary transient representations, and those representations could become different in the future. They used to be little magnetic things that would move. Now they're transistors, and they can be quantum part. You know, there could be different substrate for that. It could be biological substrate. The information is in the space of mind. In the same way that the brain is some sort of transmitter for mind, information, right, is the same, made of the same thing. And it exists in a temporary form on a hard drive, right? And so literally what you could imagine maybe is that what we're coming to from a science and technological perspective is the potential for the same kind of really cosmic transmutations that are talked about in spiritual traditions, even the cities.
It's the same thing. It's just coming from a different view. It's coming from a different quadrant.
And so then the big thing that I keep coming back to is what's the intention? What's the intention? This is how we started our conversation. What's the intention? What's the place from which these things are being designed? Because you can design and work towards uploading human consciousness into a machine because you're afraid of death.
Exactly.
Stemmed and steeped in a fundamental sense of separateness.
Yes.
Again, where are we coming from?
Right.
Or am I coming from fear? Am I coming from love and freedom? Right.
Exactly.
Right. And then what develops from that?
Yes. Exactly.
Which makes me want to ask, what if the technology isn't just in mind space, and it certainly isn't just in mind space. It's like robotics is the body side of that. And then what about the emotions? What about technology around emotion?
Yeah.
What do you see there?
So important. And actually, there have been more patents for emotion detection than, I should say, the number of patents for emotion detection in the past number of years, like 5 years or 7 years, has been more than like all of time before that.
Yeah.
So there's this huge interest. And I think what we're going to find is that the technology is going to move in levels of subtlety. And so right now, we're very much at the level of gross mind, rational sort of thought, conceptualization. That's right now the space of technology, and also where sort of collective consciousness.
And in a way, you could almost say it started at body, because, you know, servo motors and robotics,
yeah,
were like some of the first things
that were physical.
Going on. Right, it's yes. physical. And now we're getting into this enormous worldwide mind space.
Yes.
And now we're moving toward this emotional.
Now, well, and which is interesting because, again, if you bring it back to the chapters of development, levels or stages of development, it goes, you know, it goes from rational striving that does tend to be much more mind oriented mm-hmm. and moving into green, into equality, harmony, which is much more of a heart-centered heart space.
Yeah,
heart space. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting to kind of see that natural evolution through
this
the stages.
This is where we follow Dan Brown. Yeah, as we grow, we get more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
We get more access to mm-hmm. subtle.
Yeah. And I think we'll see the same thing with technology. And I think what you'll see in the future is a whole space of what I would call subtle technologies, which are actually beginning to sense into and understand the non-physical, mm-hmm. The more energetic and more subtle qualities of our human experience.
And how? Like, what do you see there?
So... there are just the beginning whispers of that stuff being possible. For example, people look at things like biophotons, which is light that's actually emitted from the body,
wow.
In very, very, very small, quantity. So you literally have to, put someone's like hand in a completely pitch dark space. Mm-hmm. And then you put a photon counter, like something that literally counts like mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3 photons.
Wow.
And then you can have like a chi master actually increase the a number of photons.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
But really, we're not there.
Right.
There aren't technologies that I know of that really can, like if you look at like, you know, people calling aura cameras or stuff like that, like that's not really what's happening. So what that will be, I don't know. I think that what we may find is that it may make sense for a while to have human beings as the bridge, meaning to actually use human beings as an antenna,
yeah. mm-hmm.
as a receiver, as a transmitter, mm-hmm. and have a sort of a technology human interface mm-hmm. that can take very sensitive people.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like in that Tom Cruise movie where he had the precogs.
Yeah.
Right? What was that movie?
Minority Report.
Minority Report, right? Where the human, the actual human beings
mm-hmm.
with special capacities were used as receivers
mm.
of information,
yeah.
but were connected in
right.
to a technology system and actually have a company.
Right, because our whole physiology
yes.
has developed for a very long period of time
yeah.
to be very sensitive to a lot of very subtle things
yeah.
that most of us don't even recognize.
Yeah.
And that's the point. It's like to even figure out how to mimic nature, we got to figure out what's going on here first
yeah.
and use us first. That's a brilliant point. I get that.
So to kind of rewind a little bit, we were talking about the different tools and you used the example of being in a meeting and kind of creating flow within a meeting. Are there any other technology tools that you see that could help to evolve consciousness and human development?
Virtual reality, in my opinion, disclaimer, this is all my opinion. All of it, every single part. So virtual reality will be the most potent transformer of human experience to ever exist. Virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, that whole space. So there has been an arms race around human attention that has been going on for decades and decades and decades and decades, arguably mm-hmm. forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where there's a recognition, consciously or unconsciously, that the ability to hold and maintain human attention is power.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we attend to, we become.
Mm-hmm.
As human beings, where we put our attention determines the very substance, the very fabric and shape of our experience, right? And so radio, television, advertisers, now apps, games, these are all increasingly powerful, potent tools designed to hold and maintain and shift human qualities of human attention. When you open your phone, what you're literally looking at is a battleground, like the most competitive, cutthroat, probably multi-trillion dollar industry.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that.
No, that sounds right. Yes. That sounds right.
And what is it designed to do? It literally, you open your phone, who can get your attention more and for longer? That's it.
Right.
That's it.
So you call it a battleground. What's the battle here? Is it a battle between those who are trying to promote higher stages of development and those who are just trying to meet their needs for power and survival?
All of it. All of it. Yeah. And whoever holds attention most will win. And so that's the battle. Who is holding that attention and for what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have virtual reality, which will be the most powerful attentional attractor to ever exist. And so now we're faced with an even more salient question, as people are literally going to be like plugging into the matrix and like spending 12 hours just like glued to like these, you know, these machines. Or when it's augmented reality, probably, you know, these are going to be, what are they called? Lens? Eye?
Glasses?
Oh, contact
lens. Sorry.
Contact
lenses
that are
lenses that are just on your eyeball that are augmented reality.
Mm-hmm.
Contact lenses where you literally aren't going to be able to tell the difference between what's real and what's not.
So do you plan to, how do you plan to utilize the VR?
Yes, sorry, this was a really long explanation. Really, really long intro to your simple question. So so now every meditation technique ever designed essentially is some sort of tool to train human attention in some way.
Yes.
To shift the quality and nature of human attention. So virtual reality is now the most powerful attractor of attention, and the goal of every meditation technique to ever exist is to shape human attention in some way, then virtual reality is potentially now the most powerful meditation tool to ever exist. And doesn't mean that's what it will be. That's what it can be if it's in the hands of people
properly,
like my housemates here, Chris and Eric, and their company Juno VR, where they're literally, that's what they're doing as a startup. They are deep meditators. These guys are spending like 1 to 3 hours a day in practice, like serious meditators. And they are trying to transmit that into the design of their virtual reality experience.
Wow, that's beautiful. So, but I just want to say that it is a little scary, this idea of everybody having, you know, web-enabled, you know, mixed and augmented reality vision of the world. We're so utterly dependent that when the bad guys get in there and change it the way they want it,
brainwash,
it's not going to be a good thing.
Yes, yes, and yes. All true.
Again, all where it comes from,
oh,
right?
My God.
All true.
We all have to get busy really fast.
All real. And all inevitable.
Yeah.
It's all going to be part of the rainbow of expression that will be emerging. And so all we can do ever is take responsibility for our own experience and what we create in the world.
Wow.
That's all we can do. And so each of us shining as bright of a light as we can.
Yeah.
And freaking that and creating from that.
You know, this reminds me what originally motivated me to get into spiritual work when I was a kid. And that is, it was perfectly obvious to me when I was 15 that the world is headed for an enormous calamity, just like, you know, a train wreck that's happening in actually rather rapid motion. You know, it's obvious we're heading in that direction because we're rapidly getting to the point where every single individual has the ability to blow up everybody else,
mm-hmm.
or targeted groups. They could just design a disease, send it out there.
And the other side of that same coin is the opposite, where I actually see a lot of evolution and change and shift for the good. And a lot of people utilizing their internal growth and development for the betterment of humanity, whether they're developing VR from that space to help to facilitate others to awaken millions of people. So I see the train wreck and I see the light and the beauty that's actually coming from these spaces.
Yeah, I see that too. Mm-hmm. It just got a little more scared at this idea of everybody having the contact lenses and like, oh my God.
I live in a really nice, optimistic bubble. I encourage all of you to, you guys are already there, but all of those listening, come join me. The water's really nice. And so what I see is just incredible. I see just beautiful, inspired, heart-centered, awakened human beings that are starting new startups, creating new interventions, shifting the way that organizations are run, shifting our financial systems, shifting our educational systems, shifting our political systems. I see all of it happening. Mm-hmm. And I have a kind of a nice tingly feeling of optimism that I like to tune into and imagine that direction is inevitable.
Yeah.
And I also like to justify that by thinking that if I imagine that I'm helping to make it more inevitable.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think our best hope is to actually change the culture enough so that the expectations and the education are all aligned with empowering individuals and empowering relatedness so that we can all live attuned with each other.
Well, it's interesting how it definitely starts as an individual internal experience, but also the power of the collective. So chicken or the egg, the collective, the rise of the collective, the rise of the individuals within the collective and how they circularly affect each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a space of increasing indiscernibility that I see the individual and the collective. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of this future arcs is the emergence of a collective consciousness with a technological substrate.
Yeah. The way I try to describe the singular phase of development, one of the ways has to do with how we feel our sense of agency. When we're younger in our development, we think, it's all about me. And, you know, it's all about what I'm going to do, what I'm going to achieve, what I'm going to make happen, mostly even from our head. I'm going to decide it and go make it happen. But the more we get developed, the more these decisions are kind of a whole being event. And then even beyond that, in the singular phase, there's this experience of almost like being a bee, part of a hive. Like, I'm plugged into the collective. I'm happy to surrender into the collective because the collective really does have more intelligence that I need in order to be fully effective as my unique self. So learning how to make that discrimination, you know, how to let go of the forms of agency that aren't helping and the forms of agency that the collective is asking us to take individually. That's what I see. And so I think that's part of what's drawing us technically in that direction, is that that's where we naturally tend to go.
Yeah, I totally agree. And even part of it is also like recognizing the illusory forms, the illusory notions of agency that we maintain that are actually inhibiting a very natural and organic deepening of our interconnectedness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to share with before we close up?
I feel good. I feel really, you guys asked great questions. Thank you so much.
You gave us wonderful answers.
Yeah, thank you so much for being a part of this. We really appreciate it. It's a joy to connect with you and talk about all this stuff. It's a huge part of what makes our hearts beat. And I think it's a huge part of probably what makes your heart beat. So it's fun to play in the sandbox with you.
Awesome.